Good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Programme. The Australian Council for Defence of Government Schools are here every Saturday to defend and to promote public education. Now, that's education that's public in purpose and outcome, but it also is public in access. It should be open to all children. That's why it is so very, very important. And no fees, no discrimination tests. No worry about parents' religion or their class or various other things. Every child is equal and should be treated equally. It also should be public in ownership and control, no public partnerships like the Labor government here in Victoria has imposed on us. And above all, it is the only one that can be public in accountability. There's almost no accountability when it comes to the private sector. They seem to be a law unto themselves. But here in Victoria, we have a problem. Our teachers, our public school teachers for years and years, probably since the year dot, have been morally blackmailed. They are just so important and they know how important they are that unfortunately they are not treated with either the respect or given the pay that they deserve. And their union representatives here in Victoria, it's not so bad in New South Wales, but here in Victoria, the union representatives haven't always been as strong as they have been elsewhere in Australia, unfortunately. And the rank and file of the Victorian teachers are very, very restive. Here we have a press release on our website, and we're going to tell you all about it.
Thanks, Jane. And this is the Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools press release number 1069. Victorian teachers are very, very restive. Rank and file teachers in Victorian schools are not happy with the log of claims being negotiated by their union with the Victorian Labor Government. They have produced a pamphlet in which they refer to the disaster agreement the union pushed them into signing in 2022. They claim they suffered an 11% cut over the life of the last agreement because of inflation and now want a deal that recognises their worth. So they are encouraging other members to vote no to the new log of claims. This pamphlet is linked on the Dogs website at www.adogs.info. Open press release 1069 and click on the link to read the full document. Dogs have always found the Victorian union leadership, but not the rank and file, to be too close to the Labor government. In particular, the leadership of previous decades sheepishly went along with the Labor government public-private partnerships, with the result that many of the now badly maintained buildings in state schools are still being paid for, while private corporations run laughing to the bank with public money. In contrast to the New South Wales Teachers Federation, the old VSTA rejected the Dogs' No State Aid for Private Schools position in the 1970s and 1980s. Its leadership were very, very close to the Labor Party and were promoted to key positions in the central bureaucracy. It has always been the rank and file who have taken a strong stand for public education alongside teacher and student rights. It was they who helped in the occupation of Richmond Secondary College in the 1990s and prevented the sale of and eventual reopening of both primary and secondary schools in Melbourne. So Dogs urge parents to support the rank and file of the Victorian teachers in their quest for better pay and conditions from the current Victorian government. Back to you, Jean.
Yes, well, thank you very much for that, Andy. And here at the Dogs and at 3CR, all strength to the arm of the rank and file teachers. 3CR and these teachers have always had a very special relationship. And if you don't fight, then you don't get the goodies. But now we're going to get a bit academic. There's academics who are very concerned about what's happening in public education and the rough deal it's getting. And to my mind, they go around a bit in circles. One of the people who goes around in circles is Dean Ashenden up there at Melbourne University. What he has to say is very interesting. Let's hear what he has to say, and then if you don't mind, I'd like to make a comment. Here he's been writing in Inside Story, Stuck, Australian Schooling Needs Restructuring, but who will do it? Well, who will do it indeed?
Thanks, Jean. This is an article by Dean Ashenden. Stuck. Australian schooling needs restructuring, but who will do it? Two new books about schooling in Australia, both by prominent commentators, mark the passage from the fringes toward the mainstream of a potent insight. Schooling's problems are structural. Jane Caro's Rich Kid, Poor Kid takes aim at the organisation of our 9,500 schools into sectors. Jeff Masters' The Children We Leave Behind tackles the even more important and more complicated question of how to structure the work of learning. Caro's little book, published by the Australia Institute in its new Big Ideas and Small Packages series, is the beneficiary of her media profile, a clear and forceful voice, and fire in the belly. To her great credit, Caro maintains her rage rather than joining the general indifference to a setup in which some can choose but many can't, in which schools for rich kids define everything else as second rate, in which those who need least get most, as well as public subsidies, and which is segregated along social, religious, and ethnic lines, yet supported by nominally Christian churches and backed by governments of all stripes. With rage comes a series of dilemmas. Blame the sector system for everything? Or concede that many government schools and systems play the choice game too, with selective schools, zones that can be bought into, out-of-zone enrolments? Point to the deep in the bones damage done to the government schools, or trumpet their virtues. Be frank about the scale of the reform problem, or keep the spirits up with assurances that progress is possible. Go for modest but attainable gains, or call for a substantial restructuring and get nowhere. Perhaps unnerved by the fact that none of Australia's nine governments wants to disturb a sleeping dog and aren't up to a big change anyway, Caro opts for a bit of everything, including canvassing Tom Greenwell and Chris Bonner's proposal for a restructured sector system. For that transgression, she's been rewarded with a stern rebuke by another prominent commentator who still thinks that fixing up the government schools will do the trick. We can hope that Jeff Masters' The Children We Leave Behind will be a turning point, but fear that it won't. Masters' conclusion, authoritative, compelling, and widely shared, is that schooling can and must be transformed. When he says at the outset that his book is not so much about teachers and teaching practices as the policies, structures, and processes that governments and school systems create and within which teachers work, he is belling the cat. Governments and their bureaucracies have spent decades telling schools and teachers that they're the ones that need to be reformed. Masters begs to differ. In fact, he insists it's the other way about. Schools and teachers can't do reform or be reformed unless and until the powers that be reform themselves and the framework of curriculum, assessment, and reporting requirements within which schools and teachers work. This is, so far as I am aware, the first time a system insider has said, clearly and adamantly, that Australian schooling is on the wrong tram and heading in the wrong direction. Masters was, until his recent retirement, head of the Australian Council for Education Research. In that role, he was, for many years, confidant of and advisor to governments and systems at both state and national levels. His argument is that things go wrong from the very first day of school. Kids arrive knowing different things in different amounts, but schools treat them as if they're all the same. For the most part, students are taught the same grade level curriculum at the same time and for the same amount of time. The reality is that some are years ahead of the starting point, some years behind. The way behind fall further and further behind as each grade's curriculum becomes increasingly beyond their reach. Most of the way behind come from what Masters refers to as poorer backgrounds. Masters laid out the bones of this case in a much discussed paper well over a decade ago, but has now expanded it in several ways. He insists that the fast expanding learning sciences do not demand direct or explicit instruction, as is so often claimed, but support the case for a restructured learning process. He details fundamental things mainstream schools can learn from alternative schools, many of them catering to the left behind, by the way. And he teases out the many ways in which centrally imposed curriculum, assessment, and reporting requirements hobble schools and frustrate teachers' deepest motivations and professional aspirations. For all its value, The Children We Leave Behind understates the problem and is stronger in analysis than prescription. Emphasizing the plight of the badly educated, Masters underemphasizes the miseducation of the majority and the consequent need for change in the scope and content of the curriculum. Kids described as disengaged or discouraged are in reality often humiliated, hurt, angry. To talk about the bad design of the machinery of schooling is to imply that the required change is just a matter of persuading the powers that be to get on with the obviously desirable redesign. The reality is much less sunny. As students advance in their school careers, they are pressed into a narrowly cognitive curriculum and an increasingly intense and explicit competition of each against all. The many components of this way of organizing schooling are tightly integrated, capable of absorbing change in any part without disturbing the whole, and heavily defended both internally, curriculum associations, industrial regulations, and so on, and externally, vested interests, popular images of school, national testing, and school surveillance systems, and the like. All this is not with us by chance or merely as the legacy of a distant era. It is school functioning as a central site of fierce struggles to maintain or advance social position. Along with many others trying to divine why schooling works as it does, Masters has been reading Michael Young's 1958 classic, The Rise of the Meritocracy, but has yet to work through the full implications of Young's argument about schooling's central role in allocating social places and class power. Facing up to structural realities means facing up to structural change, a very different thing from the bit-by-bit gains contemplated in Labor's national school reform agreements, not to mention the literally reactionary efforts of states going so far as to mandate centrally developed lesson plans. The commendable but so far modest efforts of the South Australians may prove me wrong, but a long history suggests that neither governments, never more than 3 years away from the next election, nor their bureaucracies, under the ministerial thumb and devoted to their own top-down power, will opt for structural reform unless and until they are forced into it. The best hope lies in a movement from below, a bigger and more sustained version of the I Give a Gonski campaign of 2012 and 13, bent on loosening the ties that bind schooling to its socioeconomic role so that it can move toward the kind of schooling Masters wants. First movers in any such effort would have to be, as in the Gonski campaign, the teacher organisations. They in turn would have to grasp, at last, that terms and conditions matter, but would matter a great deal more if grounded in teachers' most fundamental desire, to do really good, satisfying work with the kids. For such a movement, The Children We Leave Behind would be required reading. Back to you, Jean.
Yes, well, thank you so much for that. It's very interesting, but of course the dogs are where we just simplify things. It's really quite straightforward. The private schools never have, never will, and never can educate all the children. The people in Singapore know this, and the people in Finland and a lot of other places know this. Private schools can exist, but they should fund themselves. And now we are in the situation in Australia, by all means restructure. We're all for restructuring. But unfortunately, the academics and a lot of other people are too frightened to just take on the private school interest. We're paying for them. Let's take them over and open them up to all the children. It's really quite simple. But ever since I can remember, if you were to say this, and if you wanted an academic career, then you can forget about it. But here at 3CR, we can actually say what the truth is, and that is the truth of it. But let's have a break, shall we?
It may have been Camelot for Jack and Jacqueline, but on the Che Guevara highway, filling up with gasoline.
Fidel Castro. It's Radiothon time again. This year, the Dogs have a target of $4,500. If you're able to pledge a donation to help us reach our target, please contact the station. Call during business hours 03 9419 8377 or go to the 3CR website for more details, 3cr.org.au. You can pledge now and pay later. All donations over $2 are tax deductible. Help keep 3CR and the Dogs on air for another year.
Well, here comes the future and you can't run from it. You've got a blacklist, I want to be on it. Waiting for the right lead forward.
Are you a 3CR subscriber?
We really need our listeners to subscribe to the station. It helps us remain financially independent and is an important part of our community governance.
It's just $40 concession, $80 waged, $150 for a band or organisation, and $300 solidarity.
Become a 3CR subscriber today.
3CR Radical Radio.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
We hope you're still listening to the Dogs program. We're for free, secular and universal education from the time you're born until the time you die. And here's Maddie talking about the situation with the budget and now our students at university. Remember those lovely days that most of us in my age group, we had free education. And now we are burdening our young people with a debt when they come out of university. Let's hear from Maddie, shall we?
The budget was meant to be about fairness, so why are young people still paying $52,000 for a degree? By George Williams. Labor was right to place intergenerational inequality at the centre of the budget, but it missed an opportunity to reverse the grossly unfair Morrison-era university fee hikes. The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, rightly focused the federal budget on addressing intergenerational equity. Young Australians are being hit with a trifecta of unfairness when it comes to tax, housing, and education. They are being denied the opportunities available to other generations. While the government placed tax and housing at the centre of its economic blueprint on budget night, it missed the window to reform the greatest enabler in our society, access to education. Scrapping the discredited and grossly unfair job-ready graduates package, introduced under the former Prime Minister Scott Morrison, remains unfinished business. The scheme has already delivered $52,000 arts degrees and threatens to load students completing combined degrees with the US-style $100,000 qualifications. Education is a golden ticket to social mobility, with the evidence demonstrating how it can help young people live prosperous and successful lives. This was backed by an Australian National University study last month, which found that education was the single most consistent predictor of positive outcomes in life. People with a university degree reported higher life satisfaction, lower financial stress, greater confidence in institutions, higher satisfaction with democracy, and stronger support for democratic norms. At Western Sydney University, we see the truth of this every day. We are on the front lines of intergenerational equity. Many of our students come from poorer backgrounds, and two-thirds of our students are the first in their families to go to university. Educational attainment also crosses generations. News Corp's top public primary schools report pointed out evidence that parental education level strongly correlates with child educational outcomes. The more educated the parents, the higher the educational results of the whole school. Education is contagious. We know for our students that their success at university not only leads to better and more productive lives, it also drives positive outcomes for their children. Unlike for previous generations, some of whom enjoyed free university and others who paid reasonable contributions, the JRG is now a tax on aspiration. It is a tax on every Australian having a fair go at a better life. This broken system deepens the divide between young Australians. University is accessible to those who can rely on the bank of mum and dad, while others miss out or spend their university years in poverty or working excessive hours. It's the very definition of a regressive two-track system, remembering that the most expensive degrees in the arts and the humanities are the gateway to higher education for women, Indigenous and first-in-family students. The Treasurer was right to deliver negative gearing and capital gains tax reforms under the umbrella of intergenerational equity. As a nation, more needs to be done to remedy a situation where young Australians are denied a foothold on the property ladder. But surely the same rings true for higher education, one of the most significant forces behind social mobility and equity. Reform is also needed to achieve our intergenerational goals around economic growth. These are reflected in the government's Australian Universities Accord target of 80% of working age people having tertiary qualifications by 2050. The target is not just about fairness and access, it's about national prosperity. Reaching the target promises to add $240 billion to the Australian economy by 2050. Opening university to all Australians is not just about individual opportunity and economic benefits. Education is a bedrock of a cohesive and respectful society. In finding that university graduates are happier and more financially secure, the ANU study also highlighted that education functions not only as a source of economic security, but as a buffer against the civic disengagement that often accompanies sustained economic strain. In a world overwhelmed with turmoil and uncertainty, higher education is an antidote to feelings of social isolation and disaffection. The arts and humanities enable us to understand the world and combat assaults on our democracy from misinformation and predatory algorithms. A university education is an investment in our collective future. There is a workable remedy to the JRG. The three-step proposal would cost $1.917 billion a year, simplify the system, and reduce $52,000 plus arts and humanities degrees to $30,000. The investment compares favourably in terms of cost and fairness to the government's now fulfilled election promise to reduce existing student debts by 20%, costing $16 billion. With the opportunity missed in this year's budget, let's not delay action on this key driver of intergenerational equity until next year.
Well, the issue of the week, of course, was in The Age about digital literacy. And here we've got Andy, the expert on all this. Let's hear from Andy, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. School students have grown up online, but test shows a digital literacy at new low, and published by the ABC on the 27th of May. In short, one in three Year 10 students and one in two Year 6 students reached proficiency standards in new national technology literacy testing. The test was run in May last year by the government's curriculum agency as an offshoot of NAPLAN. The assessment runs every 3 years, and the number of Year 10 students rated proficient has fallen by almost 30 percentage points since the 2008 exam. Australian students have recorded their worst ever results in national tests that measure digital literacy, with just 37% of Year 10 students and 50% of Year 6 students assessed as proficient. Approximately 10,000 students across both year levels took the test in May last year and were marked on creating presentations, searching for information, analysing data and online safety. The testing showed concerning achievement gaps with Indigenous students, those living in remote areas and those with low socioeconomic advantage falling well behind their peers. The 2025 results show a decline in student proficiency in ICT, information communication technology literacy, and continuing gaps between different groups of students. Australian Curriculum Assessment and Reporting Authority, ACARA, CEO Stephen Gneal said, "It's our lowest level since testing began in 2005. We can see that kids are using devices more and more, but that's not translating into them having the proficiency skills that they need." The 2025 results represent a significant decline from the previous test in 2022 across both year levels. Just because you have a tool, it doesn't mean you know how to use it. It certainly doesn't mean you know how to maximise its use. That also includes not understanding the risk factors, Mr. Kneale said. These are really important skills for us to teach our children, to identify whether information is fake. Despite the poor results, most students reported they had learned at school how to search for information and assess its trustworthiness, while 80% had been taught about cyberbullying and online privacy. The testing did not include artificial intelligence, AI, skills, but a separate survey conducted at the same time asked the students about how they were using the technology. One in four Year 10 students said they used AI frequently to assist with tasks while at school, according to that survey. More than 60% of Year 10 students and almost a third of Year 6 students said they used AI to generate written content at least once a month. This confirms what we see in international research, that AI is being used for schoolwork and is being used by teachers as well, Mr. Kneale said. We need to make sure AI use is effective and appropriate, rather than just offloading the learning to a machine, and for students to continue those discipline areas of maths, English, history, science, art. Mr. Kneale said learning those fundamentals was the key to completing more complex tasks in later schooling. He also said the next test in 3 years would likely include AI in some form. Education Minister Jason Clare said he had asked the Australian Education Research Organisation, AERO, which provides advice on evidence-based teaching, with getting to the bottom of the results. These results have been trending down for two decades. At the same time, more and more children have had access to digital technology and devices, Mr. Clare said. It begs the question, what is going on here? Mr. Clare also said he intended for education ministers from around Australia to discuss AI more broadly at a meeting later this year. The even bigger question is what AI is doing and will do to learning. The challenge is to support teachers and students to use it safely, ethically, and in a way that supports learning, not undermines it, he said. Tech skills can develop over time, expert says. The technology literacy test is formally known as NAP-ICT. Like similar tests for civics and science, this happens less regularly than the annual NAPLAN test of all students, which measures basic literacy and numeracy. Blaise Joseph, a former teacher and current director of education at the Centre for Independent Studies, CIS, said while the scores were low, the skills being tested by the NAP-ICT were not as critical to get right at a young age as those measured by other NAPLAN tests. Mr. Joseph said the test did not assess AI usage, despite a CARA survey showing more than half of Year 10 students used it monthly. He also said AI had likely made some of the things that were assessed redundant. ICT skills rapidly evolve over time. For example, there are several tasks on the ICT tests which many professionals these days would use AI to complete, Mr. Joseph said. AI has already made lots of basic ICT tasks redundant, so it makes sense for the school system to focus on more fundamental skills like reading and maths that are not going to be radically different 5 years from now. Mr. Joseph said the test was still helpful for assessing students' abilities to use technology professionally, but said poor literacy and numeracy observed in NAPLAN were the root cause. ICT skills are ultimately built upon foundational literacy and numeracy skills. If students are struggling with basic ICT tasks, it's often because they're struggling with reading and comprehension first. Mr. Joseph said ICT skills could be improved upon in the workplace, unlike foundational literacy and numeracy. Students have superficial tech knowledge. Teresa Keane, a professor of STEM, Science, Technology, Engineering and Mathematics Education at La Trobe University, said more access to technology for students had not translated into a deeper understanding of it. She said that despite being digital natives, many high school students had perfunctory and superficial knowledge of technology. Professor Keane, a former ICT high school teacher, said a lack of highly skilled specialist computing teachers was hurting student achievement. You can give a student a computer, but if they don't know much more than just the basics, they're not going to move past that, she said. In many classrooms, for example, laptops are just note-taking devices. iPads are just content consumption tools for looking at the internet. We're not explicitly teaching students about evaluation of information. Is this information correct? Have you tried triangulating it? Where did you get your sources from? Professor Keane said the rise of AI made digital literacy more rather than less important. You have to be able to make sure you can use systems critically and safely. You have to understand the bias and manipulation, she said. And back to you, Jean.
Many thanks, Andy. And now it's our time to go overseas with our roaming expert, Jeff. Over to you, Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. This week we're going to start in Argentina, where the populist president Javier Milei has been cutting education funding right across the board, but specifically for higher universities, and also health funding has been under threat as well. But he's a populist leader who's very popular with Trump and Bolsonaro and other far-right populists. He was going to be sued in 2023 for running a Ponzi scheme called CoinEx, but managed to get himself elected president and thus avoided a lot of trouble. Seems to be an ongoing trend worldwide. Anyway, this is written by Laura V. Moore from a source called Telesur. Argentinian universities announced new week-long strike. Funding crisis deepens. Argentina's university community will commence a week-long general strike this Tuesday after postponing its start due to the commemoration of the May Revolution and the establishment of the first national government. The decision to initiate the strike follows widespread discontent over the Javier Milei administration policies, which have severely impacted the public education system. After the massive mobilisation in defence of public universities, the national government continues to disregard the university financing law and fails to call for salary negotiations. Denounced the Federation of University Teachers of Buenos Aires, FEDUBA in Spanish. The response to this lack of engagement, the union confirmed that they would intensify their struggle plan with a national university strike, uniting various sectors of the academic community in a concerted effort to pressure the government. This action involving teachers, non-teaching staff, technicians and students demands that President Javier Milei comply with the university financing law amidst crucial underfunding. The law, 27.795, specifically designed to guarantee essential operational and salary resources for universities, faced significant political hurdles. It was sanctioned twice by the National Congress, but subsequently vetoed by President Milei. Following these legislative actions, the National Executive then judicialised the legislation, arguing that the allocation of funds falls under the exclusive purview of the Ministry of Economy and the Ministry of Education. This legal challenge fundamentally questions the established sources and mechanisms for university financing, placing the future of public education in a precarious state and intensifying the standoff between the legislative and executive branches. The call for the strike emerges after a series of four major federal marches across Argentina, which saw significant public participation. In most recent and notable demonstration attracted an estimated 1.5 million people in Buenos Aires city and its adjacent avenues, transforming the iconic square into a sea of protesters united in their demand for adequate university funding. In the stark absence of official budgetary allocations, Argentinian university institutions are reporting a critical state of disinvestment and severe operational deficiencies. Institutions face widespread critical shortages of essential supplies, along with pervasive failures in infrastructure, which directly impede the delivery of quality education. Concurrently, the salaries of university staff have plummeted, now falling significantly below the poverty line. This dire financial situation threatens the very core functions of these vital public institutions, jeopardising the academic future of thousands of students and the professional livelihood of dedicated educators and support staff. According to a comprehensive report from the Centre of Argentine Political Economy, CEPA in Spanish, the university system is grappling with an alarming budgetary adjustment of 45.6% compared to 2023. The detailed document further indicates that salaries, which constitute 87% of the total university expenditure, have plummeted by 43.2%, while crucial operating expenses have suffered an even more drastic 57.1% cut. The report emphasises that science and university development programs are among the most severely affected sectors, threatening Argentina's capacity for innovation and long-term academic growth. The cascading effect of these cuts has led to an estimated 10% abandonment of academic chairs, as faculty members find it increasingly unsustainable to continue their work under current conditions. Alarmingly, 7 out of 10 teachers maintain only a simple dedication to their roles, with a monthly take-home salary of approximately 250,000 Argentinian pesos, which is around $178, which is barely enough to cover basic living expenses. The impending strike therefore seeks to guarantee the legal allocation of essential educational funds, aiming to restore stability and ensure the viability of public higher education as a fundamental right and a cornerstone of national development. And that's the end of the article. So trouble brewing in Argentina caused by a populist leader. Where have we heard that before? In fact, we're going to have a look at one of those aspects now from the United States. This is an article by Thomas Ulterkahn, who often appears on the Network for Public Education. It's Thomas Ulterkahn. Education privatisation propaganda is worsening. Thomas Ulterkahn is concerned about the heavy push for privatisation of public education. The 74 was created by billionaires in 2015 to accelerate privatising public education. Lately, wealthy people have been buying established media with excellent reputations. These acquired media, of course, do not exclusively concentrate on education like the 74, but they do cover it. Last November, the 74, by the way, this is my aside, the 74 refers to the number of millions of students enrolled in education. Last November, former Secretary of Education Arne Duncan joined Democrats for Education Reform President Jorge Elorza to write an opinion piece on the multi-billionaire Jeff Bezos' Washington Post. It promoted Trump's new voucher program, and on April 30th, the 74 carried an interview with Duncan, also promoting that same legislation. In the last 100 years, the two main groups championing vouchers are the super wealthy and racists, not wanting their children in school with those people. The late John Walton of the Walmart clan, the richest family in the world, campaigned continuously for vouchers, but every time he got them on a ballot in the public, rejected them. Vouchers have still never won a public vote. After Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, southern states enacted vouchers to create schools for white kids only. In 2025, the most corrupt president in the history of the United States pushed through his big ugly bill. Its tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans are paid for by reducing social services and significantly lowering support for medical costs. Lurking in the bill was also the Heritage Foundation's attack on public education, known as tax credit scholarships. It's the first ever federal education voucher program, which caused Betty Pringle, president of the National Education Association, to declare, "This bill will devastate our schools and communities, all to finance massive tax breaks for the ultra wealthy." Sadly, America truly has become the land of billionaires against workers. Voucher support is not about better education, is the subheadline. In a Time magazine article, Professor Josh Cohen wrote, "Although a small pilot phase program showed some promise 2 decades ago, new evaluations of vouchers in Washington, D.C., Indiana, Louisiana and Ohio show some of the largest test score drops ever seen in the research record, between 0.15 and 0.5 standard deviations of learning loss. That's on par with what COVID-19 pandemic did to test scores and larger than Hurricane Katrina's impacts on academics in New Orleans." In a lame attempt to refute this data, Corey DeAngelis of the University of Arkansas complained that the Indiana study was non-experimental as it compared voucher students to those remaining in traditional public schools. But because of the difficulties in creating experimentally designed voucher studies, only the DC study was experimental, and it is not likely to be repeated. In looking at the DC voucher study, the Center for American Progress published the Highly Negative Impacts of Vouchers article by Ulrich Bozer, Meg Benner and Aaron Roth. The introduction to their study states, "How bad are school vouchers for students? Far worse than most people imagine. Indeed, according to the analysis conducted by the authors of this report, the use of school vouchers, which provides families with public dollars to spend on private schools, is the equivalent to missing out on more than one-third of a year of classroom learning." In other words, this analysis found that the overall effect of the DC voucher program on students is the same as missing 68 days of school. Clearly, public policy supporting vouchers to improve education is untenable. So why are billionaires like Trump, DeVos, Koch, Dunn and others campaigning to institute education vouchers? Koch and Trump seem to have believed that they should not pay taxes in support of people who need to pay their own way and see vouchers as a path to ending publicly supported schools. People like DeVos and Dunn are Christian nationalists who believe America belongs to Christians and non-Christians are not real Americans. To them, public education is a non-Christian religion competing with Christianity. In March, Arne Duncan signed on as a senior fellow for DFR and claims to have been on 4 or 5 panels of the annual ASU and GVSV conference. The ASU and GSV yearly gathering is where the titans of the digital universe gather to discuss how to end public schools and replace them with, quote, skills-based credentialing,
unquote. Forbes magazine called the conference the Davos of education. They're calling for to replacing grade-level classes by putting children, also adults, at computer screens, earning credentials as America's primary mode of education. In her book Slaying Goliath, Diana Ravitch described the formation of DFER. She says, in 2005, several hedge fund managers launched Democrats for Education Reform at a posh party on the Central Park South in Manhattan, where the inaugural speaker was a young senator from Illinois named Barack Obama. DFER, as it's deceptively called, was founded to support school privatization by making strategic campaign contributions. Inspired by DFER, charter schools became the pet passion of Wall Street. As a new fellow at DFER, Arne Duncan is still selling the spoiled milk of his days as Obama's Secretary of Education. When George W. Bush made test-based accountability central to evaluating the nation's schools, plus narrowed their scope to math and English, a major consequence was the destruction of wonderful schools in poor communities. Despite the growing evidence that test-based accountability was harming public education, Duncan became a big proponent of evaluating schools with standardised testing. Today, that is still the method he uses to judge schools. His argument for why Democrats should embrace Trump's vouchers program is based primarily on the National Assessment of Education Progress. Testing declines since 2013. Duncan says, you saw last year's NAEP results, which were devastating, but I don't see the sense of urgency out there. It's not in his economic interest to notice that the first few years of testing saw dramatic growth in scores at schools learned to take exams and then hit a pinnacle during his leadership. As the narrow and punished theory of education was enhanced, as he pushed education technology and as the science of reading was supported by billionaires, NAEP scores started slowly declining. The 2024 NAEP results are nothing to celebrate, but certainly not a crisis. He says, almost 20 years ago, Rupert Murdoch noted, when it comes to K-12 education, we see a $500 billion sector in the US alone. The wealthy are trying to make money out of education. That's what's happening. They are what the Minnesota Governor Tim Walz calls greedy bastards. With that, I'll hand you back to the headquarters of the Dogs and wish you well. Cheerio.
Many thanks, Jeff. And now let's have a quick break, shall we?
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Looking for an easy way to keep up with your annual 3CR subscription? You can now set up an annual debit from your bank account or credit card. And once a year, your payment will be automatically deducted. You can cancel at any time and you'll get a reminder each year before payment. Be a constant supporter of Melbourne's precious independent community radio station and set up a recurring payment today. Just go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs, because this is our better section. This is the good news story. Down there in Tasmania, some of the children, well, there's a lot of poverty. Tasmania is really in a permanent depression, I think, economically, with a lot of people there. And there's the question of children, before they are learning or can learn, being well fed. And there's a question as to where the school fits in all of this. Over to Dale.
Thanks, Jean. This is an article by Jonalyn Cueto from The Educator. Calls grow for National Free School Lunch Scheme. The founder of a Tasmanian school lunch program is pushing for its expansion across Australia as nutrition experts warn food insecurity is affecting students' ability to learn. Australia remains one of the few high-income countries in the world that does not provide children with a free meal at school each day, with countries such as Japan, Sweden, and Estonia already running universal school lunch programs. Founded by Julie Dunbabin in 2020, the School Food Matters program currently serves about 21,500 cooked meals each week across 60 public schools in Tasmania, largely funded by the state government. The Tasmanian government has invested about $14.6 million over the past 2 years to support the program. Speaking as the keynote speaker at a National School Food Summit in Hobart, Dunbabin called on the federal government to back a nationwide rollout before roughly 150 delegates from across the country, ABC News reported. That's the dream, and that's what we'll be calling for action on at the end of the day, she said. What Tasmania has done is develop a very strong role model for other states to copy. Parent co-payments on the table. Each meal costs about $10 to prepare, covering ingredients, staffing, delivery, and equipment. Dunbabin said a national scheme would likely require parents to contribute about $5 per meal to remain sustainable. For sustainability, parent co-payment is going to be really crucial, she said. It's not the government's job to pay for everything, so I think that having that buy-in from families would be such a positive thing, and it happens everywhere else. Nutrition and learning at stake. Catherine Kent, a senior lecturer in nutrition and dietetics at the University of Wollongong, said the nutritional gap in many students' lunchboxes was affecting learning outcomes. We know that parents are really struggling to put food into the lunchbox that is healthy and nutritious, Kent said. There's a real opportunity for a school lunch program to ensure students have at least one nutritious meal per day. Miriam Williams of Macquarie University and the Community Economies Institute added that the stakes were high given how much of children's daily diet is consumed at school. One third of all meals are consumed at school for children, and the food that we eat is integral for our ability to function well in the classroom, Williams said. Kent cautioned that any program must ensure universal access, warning lower-income families, those most in need, should not be excluded if a co-payment model is adopted. She called for a coordinated government approach, noting food insecurity in schools was falling through the policy gaps. School Food Matters Executive Officer Kirsty Grierson said the organisation remains focused on refining its Tasmanian operations for now, with no immediate plans to introduce parent co-payments. We're very much focused on what is happening in Tasmania and really refining the program, Grierson said. Back to you, Jean.
Thank you very much for that, Dale. Now, Jeff has a very interesting news about small businesses that are supporting our state schools.
Yeah, thanks for that. I'd just like to point out that small businesses in small communities often support public schools and help to raise funds for them. There's a music shop in Brunswick called Peter Valaris Music, and I'm not plugging a particular venue, but they do provide funding for local schools, or they provide vouchers if you spend a certain amount at the shop. They put vouchers in a jar. For example, at the moment they're raising money for the Sydney Road Community School, the Merribeck Primary School, and one is the Brunswick North Primary School. And they say that any other schools in the area who want to have options for support, they should come in and they'll set up a jar and people can donate tokens towards them. The music shop in Brunswick called Peter Valaris Music. It's a nice idea. Just to mention that local businesses sometimes support schools more than the government does. Anyway, with that, I'll pass you back. Cheer up.
Yes, well, thank you, Jeff. And now we have an invitation from Sharon Burrows about school infrastructure. Let's hear it, shall we?
I'm Sharon Burrow. I'm the chair of the National Inquiry for the infrastructure required for schools for our future. Every public school should have the capacity to guarantee the very best spaces, all those elements that make up for quality teaching and learning. But we need your help. By the end of June, we would love to hear from you with a submission, whether you're a teacher, a parent, community member, a student. We would love to hear what you think are the critical elements that must be taken into account in designing our schools to provide that quality of education. Thank you for your help. We really need your support.
And that was Sharon Burrow, who is calling for submissions from all members of the community. So if you'd like to make a submission into what you think school infrastructure should look like in the future, you can go to www.schoolsforourfuture.org.au/make-a-submission. Or if you just go to schoolsforourfuture.org.au, find your way to where you can make a submission.
Thank you very much, Dale. And now, of course, we come to the best part. It might be the last part, but it's the best part, our great state school.
Every week on the Doctor Program, we have a special segment to show a different state school is a great school.
State schools are great schools.
School of the week. State school.
School of the week. Great state schools.
State schools. School of the week. School for the week here on the Dogs Program.
And this week's great state school of the week is Viewbank Primary School. A message from the principal. Viewbank Primary School has played an important role in the life of our local community since 1966, and we proudly celebrated 50 years of education in 2016. This school website has a dual purpose. Firstly, it is a resource for families considering school selection for their children. As well as viewing our website, you may wish to arrange a personal tour of the school by contacting the school office and making an appointment. Secondly, it is a detailed source of information for parents and students who are already members of the Viewbank Primary School community. Our school motto is Love of Learning, Learning for Life. Our aim is to constantly strive to improve the learning outcomes for students in an atmosphere that is caring and supportive and in which successes are shared and celebrated. Students experience a comprehensive curriculum inclusive of a range of extracurricular activities. Learning and teaching is our core business, with a strong emphasis on literacy and numeracy skills. This rigorous program is supported by a diverse specialist teaching program that includes music, physical education, visual arts, sport, performing arts, and STEM. We also provide support and extension programs for students at all grade levels. Parent participation is valued and encouraged. Parents can be involved in a wide range of activities, including membership of the school council and its subcommittees, the Parents and Friends Association, classroom support, sport, camps, excursions, uniform shop, working bees, fundraising, and family social events. We have endeavoured to make this website as informative and user-friendly as possible, and trust you find it that way. As you explore this website, I believe that you will begin to understand the community feel and excellent tone that is evident at our school. I am very proud of our school, like all our stakeholders are, staff, parents, and especially the students. Kind regards, Bill Kersing, Principal. And now some facts and figures from the MySchool website. The enrolment, 656, and the ICSEA value is above average at 1,138, representative of a diverse suburban community in northeast Melbourne. The upper 25% of socio-educational advantage, or SEA, makes up 54% of students at this school. The second quartile, 29%. The third quartile, which is below 50%, is 12% of students, and the lowest quartile of socio-educational advantage is 4% of students at this school, with 57% having a language background other than English and 1% Indigenous students. The finances, recurrent grants from the Australian Government of $1.798 million and from the Australian Government $6.68 million. Private fees and contributions add $576,000 and other private contributions $302,000. And that comes to $14,297 per pupil. The capital $7.25 million over 3 years. This school is doing an amazing job on very basic per pupil funding. In NAPLAN, the students are doing well, especially in maths. Back to you, Jean.
Well, congratulations to Viewbank Primary School. Remember that our radiothon's coming up and we have to raise a bit more than $4,500. Let's go for $5,000, shall we? Or even more. We raised $5,500 last year. So, you know, let's be ambitious, even though things are not as good as they could be in the Australian economy. But as well as that, it's now my time to thank our wonderful producer, Dale, and her offsider, Andy, and this week, Madeline and Jeff. Sorrel will be back with us in a few weeks. And from all of us here at 3CR, we'd like you to look at the Dogs website, of course, at www.adogs.info. But our time's gone, so it's bye for now.
Saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find your hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
Jacqueline, but on the Che Guevara highway, filling up with gasoline.
Fidel Castro. It's radiothon time again. This year, the Dogs have a target of $4,500. If you're able to pledge a donation to help us reach our target, please contact the station. Call during business hours 03 9419 8377, or go to the 3CR website for more details, 3cr.org.au. You can pledge now and pay later. All donations over $2 are tax deductible. Help keep 3CR and the Dogs on air for another year.
Well, here comes the future and you can't run from it. If you've got a blacklist, I want to be
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM on digital and online.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. We're almost ready to begin 3CR's annual Radiothon, where we raise funds to stay on air for another year. The dog's target this year is $4,500, so if you're able to pledge anything to help us reach our target, please contact the station. Call 03-9419-8377 during business hours, or go to www.3cr.org.au for more details.